Good morning. You're listening to WYSO in Yellow Springs. I'm Vic McCunis, and we have the Book Nook coming up for you next today. Louisa Lang Owen returns to the program. Louisa grew up in the former Yugoslavia, and as World War II ended, she was placed in a concentration camp by the partisans, Tito's partisans, and she spent a bit of time in the concentration camp and has written a memoir about it, as well as a companion book, which just came out. We'll be talking to Louisa Lang Owen about her experiences coming up in the Book Nook following NPR News. Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome back to the program today Louisa Lang Owen. She was last on the program a dozen years ago with her memoir, Casualty of War, A Childhood Remembered, and she's recently published a book which is a bookend of sorts for that first book. Welcome back, Louisa.
Thank you for having me.
Louisa, let's talk about your memoir, Casualty of War, and why you decided to write it.
Well, it was the occasion of 1992 when there was an ethnic cleansing in the former Yugoslavia. And I saw these pictures on the TV, and they so upset me. And instead of thinking, because these were the perpetrators when I was ethnically cleansed, or the German minority was banished from the country. These people, I recognized in them the victim, and I recognized myself in them. And I said, I can't watch this twice. Then I was a child, and I had no power, but now I have to do something about it. So I wrote it longhand after coming home from teaching classes. And that's how, and later I fed it in the computer, and I was appalled what kind of sentiments came out. No wonder I cried while I was writing it. So I cleared it up of all that mist, and there it was.
And this memoir, Casualty of War, is your recollections of growing up in a little village in what we refer to as the former Yugoslavia. Tell us about this village. Tell us about the place where you grew up.
Well, the village had to be talked about first because I wanted to see myself, or to have the reader see what is lost. And it was a rural village, and people were self-sufficient. There were about four ethnic groups or more individual people. There were about 5,000 people living in the village. Most of them, the larger group was Serb and Hungarian, and 500 Germans. There were Slovaks, and there were some Jewish families. And the life that I experienced since I was 9.5 years old when we left was one of integrity. And so I was raised like the flowers and the trees there. And there was this feeling of belonging, which I loved. And because my mother had a Serb friend, I was immediately bilingual. I mean, when I started to talk, because the Serb, most of the Serbs didn't speak German, and most of the ethnic groups spoke their own language and kept up their own traditions. And so there was a world in this village. It wasn't all, it wasn't like in America where everything is sort of homogenized. This was separate, but what united us is the work in the field and the way we lived, although we had different clothing, different celebrations. Even our houses looked different, so you didn't have to travel far to be in another world. And so I learned this Serb language, which also enlarged my world. And I wouldn't know what to say, just being embedded in this this village where people lived off the land. And even if they didn't speak each other's language, they were somehow united in the work that was going on.
I guess it should be noted for those of our listeners who don't know the history of this region or of Europe, for that matter, that there were German speakers all over the place. This was the former, was it the Austro-Hungarian Empire?
Right, okay. Right.
So, and what do you call yourself, Swabisch?
That was coined in 1920. They called it the Danube Swabians or Schwabians. Donau-Schwaben, we say in German. And one of the Germans gave us that name. And maybe if they hadn't, we wouldn't be so distinct. So they couldn't have gotten rid of us so quickly. No, I'm just trying to be funny, I guess.
What you're saying is that even though you were from different ethnic groups, you got along. It was a peaceful village, pretty much.
Yes, because we didn't have the same ancestry, but we had the same heritage for 300 years. So we have the same culture. We would recognize each other even when we spoke. They would say to me, if they would see me, even after, this is our German. So as distinct from a German. And so we were sort of brethren in a way, or I felt like that, and I still feel like that.
But everything changed when the war started.
Yes, the Second World War. The First World War divided us. So our relatives may have lived in Romania or Hungary, and sometimes we couldn't go visit them. But the Second World War was a catastrophe because in fall 1944 already, the Russians were chasing the Germans back. Our German fathers and brothers of age were consigned to the German, is that a word, consigned? To the German army, and so my father was in a faction of the German army. Nobody wanted to go, but that happened, and that was the first thing where the law was broken. And then, of course, when the Russians came in, that was devastating for everyone, not just the German ethnic minority. But in fall, it was already decided by Marshal Tito and his government, because it sort of came out of the woods and usurped power or received power, because it was a sort of a brethren of the Stalin and Russian communism, and they took power, and that's when they disowned the German minority. There was no law that provided for them. They took away their citizenship and everything, our fields, our livelihood, and our houses, whatever we owned, was told us already that they'd no longer belong to us. So we lived in our houses that didn't belong to us, and we waited, because we knew it was coming. And then January the 2nd at night, they did whatever atrocities there were. Most of them were killing or butchering of people, whoever they wanted to do that to. And then they took away the women from 18 to 20. 18 to 32 to Russia. My mother was 34, so she didn't have to go. And then only the old were left, the rest of the women and the children, and those which were handicapped or weren't able to even move. And they came at night and knocked on the door, and we had not 5 minutes, but several minutes, you know. Nobody looked at the watch. They stood there while we put our stuff in a sack, and they took us to the municipal building, and they took us on wagons. They were not covered into the night. They didn't tell us where we would go. So I describe this, but first in the book I describe the village, so you would see that there wasn't any kind of a threat there from any of us, and that the losses were tremendous, irrevocable losses.
Louisa Lang Owen joins us on the program. We're talking about her memoir, Casualty of War, A Childhood Remembered, which came out about a dozen years ago. And she was on the program at that time. In fact, at that time, Louisa had an event at Books & Company in Dayton for the release of the book. And we did an interview at Books & Company, which was recorded for C-SPAN's Book TV. And if you go to Google and you Google Louisa's name, Louisa Lang Owen, Book TV, you can watch that interview and see younger versions of Louisa and myself doing that interview. That's archived on the Google search engine. Louisa, this was the Russians that came in and quote, liberated the village from the Germans, occupiers.
Yes.
But for those of you of German descent, it actually meant that you were being punished. You were being imprisoned.
Well, we didn't think of that before then, very shortly before, because there was no authority there, no one to manage us, and no one cared. But the German minority was advised to flee. But they took it upon themselves, and some went with covered wagons. But it was understood that once the turmoil is over, they will come back. And some left their relatives there to take care of their houses. So we didn't want to go. Some of us didn't want to go because we didn't hurt anyone, and we were more afraid of the bombs and the war that we were going into than the Russians who are coming. And as far as we were concerned, it was a German occupation that we were getting rid of. And now a Russian occupation would come, and so what, you know? Not that we were so lightly, staying home, but some of us decided that. So we didn't anticipate that Marshal Tito and his communists, we should have, but some people did. But these were people in the land. They weren't political at all, even if they're children had to be serving. We were also, our brothers and fathers were soldiers of our king. We were loyal to our king first. Mm. Then we were Germans.
You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. My guest is Louisa Lang Owen. And we'll continue our conversation right after this. Welcome back to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. Louisa Lang Owen joins us. We're talking about her memoir, Casualty of War, A Childhood Remembered, which came out 12 or 13 years ago. Still in print. If you Google it, you can find who might have copies of it. It's still published by University Press out of Texas. And she has another book which has come out recently. We're going to talk about that here in a little while. But first, we're still talking about her memories of growing up in a little village in the former Yugoslavia, and you had mentioned a moment ago that when the Russians came in, that they did these things to your people, and then the partisans, Tito's partisans, kind of took over, didn't they?
Well, the Russians did indiscriminately to everyone, mostly rapes and thefts and getting drunk and doing whatever soldiers do that sometimes in war. But the communists had a plan for us, but we didn't know it. So first they took all our rights away, and then, of course, we were the ones that were left, that nothing had happened to, they put in concentration camps. And because no one was speaking of it, and because it was kept such a secret, even 40 years after or 50 years after, even now, 70 years after, and I've been there recently, there are places where their mass graves, they don't allow them to put a cross on it. their children go past there knowing what is there. Instead, they bury the dead animals there. Nobody is willing to acknowledge, but everyone knows that they're there. So I thought I would write this book. So I had a little anger, just a little, you know, but mostly the victims, which were they themselves that did this, or their fathers or whoever, the government then that did it. And now in 90, it was still the communist government. You know, Serbia had this Milosevic and all that. So I would see the victims as one of us, regardless if they were Serb or Croat or whatever. I have learned that from my experience. But at the time I wrote that first book, I was more concerned that this ethnic cleansing should also be counted among other ethnic cleansing, because of so many, 500,000 people lost their village, their life, and some of them, many of them died. Many of them died in concentration camps where I was. There were always 20,000 people in a little village that housed 3,000. In the house that I lived, there were three rooms with 40 people in it. But so in other words, their dying was going on all the time. You lived with crossing people that were dead. There was nobody to bury them, so to speak. They were thrown on a wagon, and they were put into a mass grave. And these mass graves are sort of abandoned as if nothing happened there. Now, in the place where I was in the concentration camp, there is a cross there, and it was initiated by relatives of survivors or relatives of those that perished there. So one winter, 6,000 people perished in the 3 months.
Well, there was nothing to eat, was there? I mean, weren't you eating grass and weeds?
Well, we got there in October, so whatever there was left, little roots and stuff, and they forgot to feed us at first. Uh-huh. But then they were giving us. But before we came to this bad camp, there were already smaller camps where things were a bit better, you know, because small camps, and you could have potato soup or whatever, gruel. I don't know how those things that are called, you know, but and grits and stuff like that. But here they forgot about us because there was 20,000 of us, and that required some kind of management, and they're not good at that. They're good at management. Yeah. And so they forgot about us for at least 2 months, you know. And then they gave us a little bit of this, but not continuous food. And there was, of course, no electricity and no warmth of any kind through the winter. So, but before we get too morose about it. You know,
yeah. The book is Casualty of War, Childhood Remembered. Louis said there are a couple things that really stuck with me after all these years since I read the book. And one is, I think you're in transit to the camps, and there are these soldiers guarding you, and you were singing a song that they liked. Am I remembering this right?
Yes, yes.
You want to talk about that?
Yes. That was our first internment. It was in a sheep stall. That, of course, is empty in winter, and that was in January. Very, very cold. But they had a fire in the sheep stall, and they gathered around it, they meaning the guards with guns. And they also had a guitar, and they played. But we were so frightened, and because they're only old men, and my grandfather was especially frightened. And so we were sitting on this embankment of straw. I guess the animals used to be in there. And so I had to go outside, you know, to pee, excuse But I had to go outside, and I sort of remembered how they let people out by tens or so, and I was hoping they would let me out. And so I came down that straw slope, and I had to pass their fire. And to this day, it seems to be screened off for me in my mind by chains, but it wasn't. There were probably bales of stuff. And they were, I was caught up by this love song, like a beautiful, and I just sat there, and I forgot that I was in the concentration camp because the guards were singing Serb. I knew I was back into my village, so to speak, and I said, I know, I was 9 and a half, and I said, I know a sad song too. So they were very surprised at first, because here I was speaking their own language, and then one of them lifted me up, and I sang my song. I had to sing it again, and the second time, I wasn't as scared.
What was the song, Louisa?
The song was, they had already taken my mother away, and so it was particularly meaningful to me, and I sung it with all I had. And it was about a child who lost its mother.
Mm.
And so I was known from then on in other camps, but not in the big camp, the little girl that sings. So,
mm-hmm. Louisa Lang Owen joins us. We're talking about her memoir, Casualty of War, A Childhood Remembered. And after you got out of this situation and you were still in the former Yugoslavia, I can remember another thing from your memoir where you talk about, I think you're at a train station,
mm-hmm.
and you spot the man who was the commandant of the camp. And this is a very powerful moment for me as a reader. I'm sure it was for you living it.
Thank you for remembering it. I'm amazed. But it was in a camp, you don't have connections. No matter if you can sing or if you're special, not nobody cares. And you learn that. So all those specialties last for seconds. And then another thing comes about. And so we lost our connection. And then there was a very cold winter. And my mother was frustrated. And she knew she couldn't. Grown-ups couldn't achieve anything, so she sent me to meet the commandant. And I thought she was joking, and I thought the people in our room, which was a small little cupboard room, were also joking, but it was true. I had to go meet the commandant. And it took me some time to meet, and when I finally, 3 days, had to have the courage, because he would come in, you know, early in the morning, and he had a shotgun. He was very tall man, very tall, and also very exclusive. And I later watched him with his friends, communists. They were scared of him as well. Mm. And so I had to approach him, and he took me. All I wanted is a warm place to be. That's what my mother asked him to do. But I didn't say that. I just said, if there's a warm place, I would like to work. And he took me there, and he introduced me to the office people as the girl that he caught running away. And for a second, I thought I was insane. It so scared me because they shot people that tried to run. And so I had this, and at the end, he sent me to the kitchen to be the helper for the cook, who didn't like me either, because she had someone already in mind. So in other words, when the camp was finished and no one was interested in the commandant, I was, my mother was consigned to hard labor in Borsky Rudnik, that is a mine for gold and copper mostly. And she worked there, and so I was first time going to school at 13, and I was going, and I had to pass a railroad station, and there he was. I recognized him even with his back toward me. And I wanted to avoid him.
Mm-hmm.
And I took a step over the curb, and I was ashamed. So I went back, and I faced him. And he wanted me to he wanted to accompany me to my school, and I said no, and I had fallen and I had scraped my knee because I had to go through a gorge, and he took me to a station, a first aid station there by the train. It was so embarrassing for me as a little girl, but he said, as he left, he said that you are the only one among them that I managed not to hate. And I felt so bad. It's nothing worse he could have said to me. You know what I mean? Like, I hate all of you. And but I had a way as a child to see the humanity. I saw his concern for the knee. And I think, in a way, my experiences were always such, maybe they weren't severe enough, that I was allowed to go back to the village, to that integrity, and I could see the humanity in him when he asked the person who usually was dealing with big things that happened at the mine to dress a scraped knee, you know. So you will remember that very well.
Yeah, it's a very powerful book. The book is Casualty of War, A Childhood Remembered. Louisa Lang Owen wrote it. She's our guest today on the program. And as I indicated, this is a bookend interview because we're going to have to flash forward through the decades very quickly to get to this current project. Louisa and her family ended up passing through Germany after the camps, and ended up eventually in Cincinnati. And flashing forward even further, Louisa had a career at teaching at Wright State University. She's now retired. Louisa's an artist and has lived in Yellow Springs for many years. And you've gone back to your former village. You have made these trips back, and I think that this must have been a catalyst in a way for this current project. Is that right?
Yes. I first went back with my son and daughter-in-law, and then I went back taking my grandchildren and my oldest grandchild, Marina. She loved it so much. She wants to, it seemed familiar to her. And Una and Marina and I went back in 13. That was not too long ago. And they both liked it still. So was there a question I missed by telling you all this?
Let's talk about where the second book came from. The second book, I will let you pronounce the title. This book is written in German, and it was published overseas. Tell us about this project. How did this come about?
Well, I was always concerned about having the book translated into other languages, mostly German, because the survivors or their children and children's children, whatever, would be interested in this, not because of the sake of the book, but because of their sake, to understand their relatives that had survived, and because they've talked about it. So I wanted it to promote the book so it would get translated. Then I was invited by a committee for dialogue, peace, and reconciliation that took people to Yugoslavia. I mean, then it was already Serbia. So we went there, 120 of us, on a ship from Bulgaria or something. So we went through Vienna, Budapest, and then down to Novi Sad, to the concentration camp. And there awaited us a delegation of all kinds of dignitaries, and both in government and mostly also the churches. And so they took us to the site. This was the first time, and I knew I was going there to go to the site where the mass graves were, because we couldn't go there. And since they then lied about that they're not even there, you know, we knew they were there, but we never, nobody ever went and looked for them. And so they took us there where there was now a cross there, the cross that had been in the village, in the destroyed church. There was this cross, this marble cross. And it was a very, very cold day in November the 3rd or something like that. And it was just an experience which I hadn't anticipated. I didn't know how I would feel. And I was right. There was no way of knowing. And I saw the bishop and many Orthodox priests, and they had the seminary students there singing. It was a sort of a Orthodox mass. And that was in itself, you know, sort of that willingness of dialogue, peace and reconciliation. And the bishop spoke, but he had a translator, and the wind just tore everything apart. And I thought I owed it to the dead. I don't know how I got the idea to hate them all. And the 120 Germans, no of them, 10 were in concentration camps, but only one, a younger woman, was in that, the biggest, most terrible concentration camp. And I felt I wanted them all gone because I had too much trouble with my private feelings. And something happened all of a sudden. I don't know whether I thought or whether it was a flash of insight that came from nowhere. I looked at the seminary students, they were young boys, and I thought, in 92, they were as young as I was when they did that to us. And I just was overwhelmed by love, and I hope I'm not going to start to cry, but there I probably wept. But people were a little afraid because the year before they had such a delegation, you know, I wasn't, and it was Hammerstiel who illustrated my book that went across this field with a divining rod to try and find his relatives. That's how crazed he was, you know, and I guess they were afraid that I would do some crazy thing, so they held me up. So I cursed them. I mean, I had a terrible time, you know what I mean? Till this flash of insight or this, I call it a piece of grace, you know, where I thought, no, there's no need for hate because you can't do it. You know what I mean? I couldn't do it. And it was, so I wrote the bishop because of, we also went to the cathedral and then we went to the parliament. We did the whole thing. But at the cathedral, the bishop gave, and together with a priest that came with us, they celebrated mass with, Orthodox mass, 2 hours standing. It was very beautiful to watch. And the rituals are beautiful. And the bishop suddenly spoke the German that even I couldn't speak. You know, he was fluent in German. It so impressed me, but it also, I felt betrayed because at the graveside, he had a translator. And I think I know why, so that people couldn't say he said something that he didn't. But in the cathedral, he was at home there. So I wrote the first poem for him. But even that was a confrontation. I said that I addressed him as you, and I told him that he should forgive me for not using the names that he is accustomed to, you know, Your Excellency, this thing, because I think names divide us. I don't like them. And so I approached him like you, and I told him he also addressed us as guests, honored guests. And I said, I am no guest. I have even the most, the poorest person has a place which they call home. and I take mine, what's due me. So I don't mean to insult you. I don't mean to ask you to give me a place. You know what I mean? Mm. I just confront a confrontation that was asking him to asking him for this dialogue. And then I invoked Saint Francis. It's the that's why it's called this Bishop's Clyde. You know, Rilke wrote a poem about. It's called the Book of Hours, and the third book is about poverty, and death. And so, Saint Francis is the patron saint or the spokesman for the poor, who took his clothes off at the marketplace in front of the bishop's regalia, the riches of power. He exposed his humanity. And I wanted this to be the messenger that all this power for oppression has to be faced by more by this power to give or to love or to understand. And so I learned something in the second book. It's not the same intent, the second book, as the first book was. The first book was to acknowledge this happening and to allow us to be part of the survivors that know something that other people don't know. And I would like to speak about that. But the second book is more like this realization, what causes such things, or what a remedy would be, like Saint Francis, you know, showing what should be done.
You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. Louisa Lang Owen has joined us, and we're going to have Louisa read one of her poems in just a moment. But first, this. The Book Nook continues. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's always a pleasure to talk to Louisa Lang Owen, and especially on the radio, because you can listen in, and Louisa has this new book out. It's in German, and it's kind of a bookend. If you've been listening to the interview, you know that we were talking about her memoir, Casualty of War, A Childhood Remembered, and this book is very much an outgrowth from that first book. It's got these amazing, would you call these woodcuts?
Yes, yes.
Amazing illustrations to go along with your poetry. Tell us about the artist who did these woodcuts.
The artist was also in a concentration camp, not in the same concentration camp, and he and his mother managed to escape the last year from a camp that was closer to the border. So anyway, but he knew somehow or other, I knew about his work. And his work, he's very famous in Europe, and he's showing his work everywhere in Europe, and even lived in New York and worked there. And he has paintings, but he was most known for his woodcuts. And I saw them, and they have this, the ethnic Germans were sort of embodied in this woodcut. So I saw these woodcuts, so I wrote him, and I asked him, and I sent him my poetry. And I asked him, would he mind if I use some of the existing woodcuts that I see on the internet? And would he help me to select certain ones or tell me where to find certain ones by reading my poems? Well, he wasted no time but sent me 15 woodcuts that he said there's nothing that could stop him after he read my poems. So he made those woodcuts, especially for the poems, and they're so powerful. And they're not like his usual work because it's more figurative, his usual work. And maybe because I was American and he lived in New York and he loved it so much, he wanted to go most modern. So I only think that. I don't know. He hasn't said. But he was so very interesting because we were at a reading together in 2013, and he pointed out that the bishop, of course, is very tall, you know, and he pointed out the first illustration, and he said to me, I made you bigger than the bishop. And it's the same man that went with the divining rod, you know, so he has a childlike expression, but he gave his life, he said, I gave my life to my people with my work. And he laments, you know, that some of us are not artistically inclined.
Luisa, these poems are in German, but I want you to read one, even though a lot of us probably aren't going to understand the poem. Then maybe you can explain a little bit, paraphrase what the poem was about. Do you want to read one for us?
Yes, because we just left off saying about this thing that the book is about something else than the first book was. And so in the cathedral, the bishop gave a sermon in German. And then this came, of course, I wrote a wonderful, admiring him. The first poem was dedicated to him, but the second poem already was something else, and maybe it's shorter and I can read it. Hopefully I can see, okay. And it's in German, auch wir haben Tote. He said, we too have dead. So he said, so auch wir haben Tote, verlegen, fast trotzend, vielleicht zu aller Schutz, der Schuld bewusst, anklagend, fast sagst du, wir haben auch Tote. Als wollte man sie dir zurückverlangen, die unsern. Wer sind wir und was das Unsere, wenn wir die Toten teilen? Das weiß der Gebeine sich selbst nur gleichend, uns weit entrückt, und wie es zählen zurückrufen, dass ihre, das nie uns gehörte, auch keines Grundes eigen ist. Asche zu Asche, in Ewigkeit sich einend, das unbeherrbar Bleibende schweigt, duldend der Eitelkeit mitten in uns.
That's it. And the poem's saying, what's it saying?
It's saying that he says, we too have dead, as if we're asking him to give ours back to us. And who are we when we divide the dead? I mean, they no longer even resemble us, you know, the bones and stuff, you know. And what was ours then that we want to take back? So I sort of accuse us, the dividing ourselves to the point where we divide the dead. And we say at the end, I say that dust to dust, I guess. We say ashes to ashes, you know. Forever united or something like that. The forever remaining suffers the insult of this division, of our pride. You know, it's a sort of accusing thing, not of the bishop as such, more of ourselves, because we do that. I think that my experience or anybody's experience as a survivor of a concentration camp brings with it a knowledge that should be listened to and is usually perverted and is even taken away from the survivor. I think that the people that were in Rudolfsknecht, Veraivos, Knichanin, are, and the people that were in Auschwitz, in Rwanda, in Bosnia, it's, we were all there. We have left names, be. We don't need the name to identify us. The experience identifies us. And such divisions, we know, will cause further concentration camps, because when we divide ourselves, we see the other does this, not I do that. And so it's these terrible things can teach us about love. There's nothing else that is going to prevent us from doing this over and over again. We can repeat all we want. I'm doing this to never forget. They've already forgotten. You know, they lament at a mass grave, and they're already digging a mass grave for the other. All this wisdom that the victim has, if it isn't perverted, has to be listened to. And if it isn't, the victim still has the obligation to speak. And the last part of the book is such a thing, the poems hint at that, that we cannot afford to ignore the cry in the desert. I have this poem, the last poem, because every cry in the desert is seeking love. So we have the obligation, no matter how atrocious a deed is, to see the human in it, so that we don't divide ourselves from the, become perpetrators and victims, so it may be a very grandiose idea. To me, it's simple. It's very simple. It's not that it's a simple fix. It probably never be fixed. But you can have an insight, and that has some value.
The book is beautifully done, and this was printed in Serbia?
Yes, in Serbia, in a village. And the publisher, of course, has taken it to book fairs in Leipzig, in Frankfurt, and in Belgrade. And in Belgrade, the bishop just happened to
be. Is that a photo of the bishop?
Yes.
Wow.
And he's tall. Tall and
that's
bearded.
That's quite a beard he has.
Yes.
And so he would be Serbian Orthodox?
Yes, and okay. He's very intellectual, a philosopher, theologian. He speaks 13 languages. I wouldn't dare approach the bishop in real life, but I gave him all I got in my book. But it's so, I just received that.
That's a wonderful photo. This gentleman's holding your book up in front of the bishop.
Yes. And he's taking it, but...
And he looks like a bishop.
Yes.
Yeah.
But that's, he's not in full regalia. He's not a Rilke's bishop.
and tell our listeners the name of the book again.
The book is called This Bishop's Clyde, and it's illustrated by the woodcuts of Robert Hammerstiel, and he's a famous artist, but the book was designed by Doug Snyder.
Is that our Doug Snyder?
Yes, our okay. Doug Snyder. And even to the how, where things should be placed, where this should be placed, the information from the publisher uh-huh. allowed him to do that. So I think they called it in Europe, the Goethe Institute was interested in it, and they call it the beautiful book. Probably of how it looks, you know, than what is its content. I don't know.
It is beautifully done. And it's really great to reconnect with you again on the program, Luisa, with this this bookend to our first interview from 12, 13 years ago. I see we're running out of time, but I see you around town, and I'm always very happy to see you.
So am I. And I'm just getting started. What will I do with all this energy now?
Well, I guess we'll just have to have you come back some other time and we'll do another program. But once
thank
we
you
get
very
you,
much.
Once we get you going, Louisa, you know, you go. So thank you so much for everything. Don't be sorry.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And it's a pleasure to be with you. You know, I told you that.
You've been listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. My guest has been Louisa Lang Owen. And as I mentioned earlier, I interviewed Louisa on WYSO 12, 13 years ago for her memoir that we discussed in the first half of the program. And then we had an event at Books and Company. Louisa had a book signing there, and she had a really great turnout. And it was actually filmed by C-SPAN's Book TV, and that is archived. So if you want to watch that interview at Books and Company, Louisa talking about her first book, you can find it by Googling her name, Louisa, L-U-I-S-A, Lang, L-A-N-G, Owen, O-W-E-N, at Book TV, and it'll come right up, and you can watch the interview through the wonders of the Internet, which really wasn't an option when we made that original recording. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks for listening, and thanks, Louisa.
Thank you.
Be sure to tune into the Book Nook on Sunday morning at 10:30 when John Dean returns to the program. John's book, The Nixon Defense, has just come out in paperback. John was White House legal counsel, and he was instrumental in the collapse of the Nixon administration. That's coming up in the Book Nook tomorrow morning.